Penguin Random House Audio presents White. This is the author, Bret Easton Ellis. For Matthew Spector. Society mediates between the extremes of, on the one hand, intolerably strict morality, and on the other, dangerously anarchic permissiveness, through an unspoken agreement whereby we are given leave to bend the rules of the strictest morality, provided we do so quietly and discreetly. Hypocrisy is the grease that keeps society functioning in an agreeable way. Janet Malcolm, The Journalist and the Murderer. Somewhere in the last few years, and I can't pinpoint exactly when, a vague yet almost overwhelming and irrational annoyance started tearing through me maybe up to a dozen times a day. This annoyance was over things so seemingly minor, so out of my usual field of reference, that I was surprised by how I had to take a deep breath to dismantle this disgust and frustration that was all due to the foolishness of other people. Adults, acquaintances, and strangers on social media who offered up their rash opinions and judgments, their mindless preoccupations, always with an unwavering certitude that they were right. A toxic attitude seemed to drift off every post or comment or tweet, whether it was actually there or not. This anger was new, something I'd never experienced before, and it was tied in with an anxiousness, an oppression I felt whenever I ventured online, a sense that I was going to somehow make a mistake instead of simply offering an opinion or make a joke or criticize someone or something. This idea would have been unthinkable 10 years earlier, that an opinion could become something wrong. But in an infuriated, polarized society, people were blocked because of these opinions and unfollowed because they were perceived in ways that might be inaccurate. The fearful began to instantly see the entire humanity of an individual in a cheeky, offensive tweet and were outraged. People were attacked and unfriended for backing the wrong candidate or having the wrong opinion or for simply stating the wrong belief. It was as if no one could differentiate between a living person and a string of words hastily typed out on a black sapphire screen. The culture at large seemed to encourage discourse, but social media had become a trap, and what it really wanted to do was shut down the individual. What often activated my stress was that other people were always angry about everything, presenting themselves as enraged by opinions that I believed in and liked or thought were simply innocuous. My pushback against all of this forced me to confront a degraded fantasy of myself, an actor, as someone I never thought existed, and this in turn became a constant reminder of my failings. And what was worse, this anger could become addictive to the point where I just gave up and sat there exhausted, mute with stress. But ultimately, silence and submission were what the machine wanted. The idea of beginning a new novel started whispering to me sometime in the first weeks of 2013, while I was stuck on the I-10 in traffic merging into Hollywood, after I had just spent a week in Palm Springs with a friend I'd gone to college with in the 1980s and who was now losing her mind. She had broken down in front of me several times during those days in the house on Azure Court, before leaving earlier than expected to attend a Deepak Chopra retreat in San Diego, and yes, I know how this sounds. In Palm Springs, I was unexpectedly crippled with waves of anxiety that kept me in bed for hours staring at my phone, vague yet vast realizations about mortality that my friend's frailties had activated and encouraged, while also absurdly, furiously going through the last demented round of notes on a pilot I was writing for the CW network. Between the bouts of fear and the never-ending phone calls from the production company and the rewrites, the thought that I might never write another novel announced itself more loudly than it had in years, and my last novel had been completed in 2009. Why this idea asserted itself at this particular time, I can't tell you. The desire to write prose had kept pulsing faintly within me for years, but not within what I now saw as the fake enclave of the novel. In fact, I'd been wrestling away from the idea of the novel for more than a decade, as evident in the last two books I published. One was a mock memoir wrapped within a horror novel, and the other was a condensed autobiographical noir I pushed through painfully during a midlife crisis, a story about my first 3 years back in Los Angeles, futilely working on movies after I'd lived in New York for almost 2 decades. For those past 5 years, I had no desire to write a novel, and had convinced myself I didn't want to be constrained by a form that didn't interest me anymore. And yet I was willing to be constrained by the conventions of the 100-page screenplay that would never be made, and the 5-act TV pilot that would never be shot. I had reiterated all of this firmly in interviews I'd given over that period, during the world tour for that last novel I'd written, at press junkets in Spain, in Copenhagen, in Melbourne. But out in the desert, that feeling evaporated. And between the notes calls and the fear tamped down by Xanax and tequila, as the mountains surrounding the house darkened beneath the late afternoon winter skies, the first paragraph of a novel began to take shape. It started with an image revolving around the bone-white Emser tile sign situated on a rooftop at the intersection of Santa Monica Boulevard and Holloway Drive, the view from behind the windshield of a stolen car, a violent accident, an unfolding mystery, something about the past, that last year in high school, intimations of a murder disguised as a suicide, somebody pretending to be somebody he wasn't, an actor. I've never forced a novel, something my agent and publishers and readers might think is part of an overall problem with me as a writer or as a brand, namely because I've gone 5 or 7 or 8 years between books at a time when most people still expect a brand name novelist to publish every other year like clockwork. This was what my publishing house had expected of me in the 1980s after my first novel was a success, and I still remember my shock at being told this. In the end, I never worked like that, and yet this didn't ever mean I wasn't writing. It meant only that I wrote in a way that simply worked best for me. I wasn't thinking about anyone else when I wrote. I wasn't aware of an audience waiting for me outside my apartment, and I never really cared what my agent or editor or publisher expected from me. With my publisher, I made sure deadlines, if any, were flexible, and they were, and in return, I agreed to publicize the books as much as the publisher required me to. And I never succumbed to the temptation to give an audience what I thought they might have wanted. I was the audience, and I was writing to satisfy myself and to relieve myself from pain. I rarely gave interviews between book publications because part of the process was still mysterious to readers, with a kind of secret glamour that added to the excitement with which books were once received, whether negatively or positively. But novels don't engage with the public on that level anymore. I'd wistfully noticed the overall lack of enthusiasm for the big American literary novels the autumn before I met that friend in Palm Springs. But I also realized that's nothing to worry about. It's only a fact. Just as the notion of the great American studio movie or the great American band has become a smaller, narrower idea. Everything has been degraded by what the sensory overload and the supposed freedom of choice technology has brought to us, and in short, by the democratization of the arts. I started feeling the need to work my way through this transition, to move from the analog world in which I used to write and publish novels into the digital world we live in now, through podcasting, creating a web series, engaging on social media, even though I never thought there was any correlation between the two. After that week in the desert with a friend I've known for 30 years, after I'd seen her driven mad by her life, while I endured the endless rewrites of a sci-fi pilot that was never going to happen, something in me finally cracked, and I began making notes for a novel in that last week of January, but it has never turned into anything either. Empire. I was unusually attracted to horror movies as a kid growing up in the San Fernando Valley of the 1970s, when they spoke to me in a way nothing else seemed to. I might have known one or two believers who loved them as well, but for the majority of my friends in that movie-mad decade, horror was just another genre, no more meaningful to them than the teen sex comedy or the disco musical. But what was it about horror movies and horror novels and comic books that caught my attention more than anything else? On its surface, the house I grew up in was just another modest upper-middle-class home along the edges of the hills in Sherman Oaks, but below that surface was a hugely dysfunctional gray zone. I grasped that dysfunction at a very early age and checked out, realizing I was alone. As a 1970s kid, there were no helicopter parents. You navigated the world more or less on your own, an exploration unaided by parental authority. In retrospect, my parents, like the parents of the friends I grew up with, seemed incredibly nonchalant about us, not at all like parents today who document their children's every move on Facebook and pose them on Instagram and urge them into safe spaces and demand only positivity while apparently trying to shelter them from everything. If you came of age in the 1970s, this was most definitely not your childhood. The world wasn't about kids yet. I remember long stretches when I might not have even seen my father, apart from the occasional weekday breakfast or dinner on Sunday, as from Monday to Friday he would have left for his job at a downtown real estate firm before my sisters and I were awake, and wouldn't return to the house in Sherman Oaks until we had finished.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?